So welcome again. Welcome. Nice to see you all. Tonight I want to continue the series of looking at spiritual practice from a sense of a continuum, of moving from something towards something else, and remembering the place where we're moving is often can be an incentive, that there's a possibility of an alternative to where we start. And as we practice, we should be feeling that alternative. And I'm giving you different expressions of what that means, different definitions. And that way, you can choose one that fits most comfortably with your own path, your own direction. Tonight, I want to talk about suffering and the end of suffering, which is sort of the generic way that the path is unfolded within the Buddhist tradition. And it's an interesting question, because it's not as if we don't know what suffering is, except perhaps in its most nuanced expression. We're pretty aware of what it means to struggle in our life, and the dissonance of living and the contradictions and the just the difficulty. It's hard. Life is hard. So it's not, that's not where this is going. It's whether we have struggled enough is really the question that's at hand. Because until we have, we will use struggle as kind of a way to self-define ourselves. And some of us get caught in identifying with our suffering, with our struggles, in some kind of an ennobling way. You know, how can you expect me to be any different than I am when I had the mother I had? You know, that I've had to overcome an awful lot before I got here. It's sort of like the political conventions, to hear person after person get up there and, you know, talk about the difficulties of their life and how they've had to overcome. Well, you know, you can get very identified with how our life has unfolded and the difficulties we faced within it. But there's a point in which struggle actually becomes an incentive towards leading a different life. And something, I think that's really a threshold of a kind of wisdom that some of us have, perhaps all of us in the room here, where we realize, you know, enough is enough here. You know, I can get out of this. I'm not deserving of my struggle. And so many of us think we are. When you have a mood, or when you have something that comes up in your consciousness and you don't even arrest it, you don't even look at it, aren't even interested in it, because it's such a patterned way of relating to our life, that we just throw our energy into whatever it is that's saying, and often it's very discouraging information that it's coming through as a mood or an attitude. But at some point you get, when we realize that the definition of suffering is really self-induced, it's having an internal response to an objective occurrence. And that internal response can be adjusted. If we have lived with a sort of disadvantaged way of looking, we can adjust this thing. This thing isn't beyond our control. In fact, it's well within our reach. And that's the optimism of Buddhism, is that we're not stuck wherever we claim ourselves to be. But we have to have the incentive to want to get over it. If we're too identified with it, if we have a strong sense of deserving what we're getting, then we're never going to have the energy necessary to discover its antidote. So it's up to us, really. From beginning to end, it's up to us. And some of us just like to hear about the fact that we can get over it, but do nothing to actually get over it. Well, that's another form of self-recrimination, really. It's just too hard, you know, I'm just not good enough, or all of whatever it is that we say to keep ourselves from actually investing in the energy necessary. So we're up against a lot in this word struggle, this word suffering. And what I would like to do tonight, well, first of all, I just want to say, Dharma practice is really living our deserving quality of life, to living life as if it were deserved to be lived, rather than to suffer as if suffering was the deserving part of life. You know, existence is, we're deserving of existence. We're not deserving of the struggles within existence. And it might sound nuanced in terms of the difference of that, but it's considerable when you really understand that we pile it on to ourselves here. And so tonight I want to look at different levels of the way we suffer, and some of it gets a little bit subtle in how we do it, but I want to move you from some of the more gross aspects to the more interesting, I think, in terms of, I can look at struggle this way. Oh, maybe this is the way I need to face it and take it on. And what I would like to do is to start off with a very generic, when we're getting into Buddhism, we may start reading the Buddhist literature, and the first thing we come up with or come up to is the Buddhist Four Noble Truths. And so life does contain a certain conflict and difficulty within it. But then the second noble truth is that desiring or fearing, fear and desire are really two sides of the same coin, is the reason that we do. So now we have something to land upon, something that's a place to begin. So what does that mean, though? You know, what does it mean? Okay, so we listen or read books and we find out that, you know, and begin to tune into the fact of the experience of desire. I'm desiring. And we think, okay, well, I can take this on. And I remember doing all sorts of antics to try to work with my desires, you know, from like closing myself in a closet for a whole weekend just to going out for toileting, but everything else, I was going to see what would come up, right? Well, a lot came up, and it wasn't what I would suggest others doing. But it was helpful in the sense that you begin to really take it on seriously. What is desire? Can I get my hands around this thing? You know, what am I supposed to do? Stop it? Am I supposed to stop desiring? Am I supposed to arrest it? You know, I read some literature and it says I'm supposed to have, sense deprived or renounce the senses that sense desires, but I don't know. How do you renounce a sense desire? You know, I don't want it anymore. I'm not going to turn that way anymore. What is that? That doesn't feel very satisfactory, and it feels like more struggle to me. I'm going to struggle against this struggle. You know, somehow that never made a lot of sense to me. So when I got caught up in desiring and looking at desiring, and at first we're going to try to tame that desire. Okay, I'm going to do whatever is necessary in order to sort of to water it down so that it's not quite as momentous. It doesn't carry quite the strength. But I can't. You try to quiet it, and then in a moment of blindness, you know, the reactions are up again. You're right back where you started. So what I figured out in the course of things is that the only way through this thing was not to protest the desire that's arising, but to inquire into it, explore it, see what it was. And that kind of came to me on my own, actually. Mostly I'd heard from my teachers, just see it as aversion or attraction. Well, so aversion and attraction, I can get a feeling for that, you know, but it never really went anywhere. And sometimes I could feel having an attraction or an aversion to something and being able to hold it instead of play it out. But then the next time it came, I played it out. I didn't feel like I was getting anywhere. I felt like it felt because I was giving too much validity to the desire. I was making it into something that was true and some true perspective, some enemy of mine. Well, that wasn't very helpful, and I knew that I wasn't going to get far that way. So for me, the exploration end of it was very inviting. And as soon as I started to explore it, you see, and this was crucial. You see, what is a desire as a, what's happening in the mind when a desire arises? Not just desiring, but what is the mind doing when it desires or when it is afraid of something? And it was at that point that the whole thing sort of fell into place. I could say, oh, yeah, I'm creating a fictitious idea. It's an imaginative response. I'm thinking of something outside of what is being offered, of what I want. So it's future. It's a future, it's propelled by the future. Okay, so now it sent me into time. So what's time? You see what? Now, okay, so there must be, what's the future? When I couldn't find the future, and I couldn't find the past, when I tried to find it, I couldn't find it. And yet desire was telling me very explicitly that there was a future. And so was fear. If you do this, this will happen. What I want is not here now, but if I do certain things, it will be. But so that was it's an imagination. It's an imaginative response. Now, all of a sudden, that cut the reality of it. It no longer was something real to me. It's an imaginative response. And that somehow seeded a whole different relationship to desire than treating it as something that was this mental reality that kept coming intruding upon my life, that upsetting me when it was there and, you know, blocking my spiritual progress and all of that. It was an imaginative response. That's a very different way to handle something that's imaginative rather than something that is real. So now, what do we do? So we have a desire. But the context of the moment isn't lost within the desire. And always before, when a desire occurred, I lost context. I wasn't here. I was wherever the desire would take me. So the imaginative response was really a play of thought. And I began to see that only thought leaves the present. Nothing else can leave the present. Only thought. And thought was an imagination. So in truth, nothing could leave the present. It would make me think that something could. I would lose context, but I would lose context in imagery, not in reality. And so then, now this thing's starting to make sense to me. And as soon as I lose context to the present, I struggle. Duh. I mean, it's like obvious, but it's not obvious. And so you go, okay, so that's interesting. So now I have something that I can really understand here. And it gives me a basis or a way forward. And in fact, you see, the seeds of this really carry you right on through. If you look at how you suffer and begin to understand the intricacies of suffering, of the reality of what the mind is doing when it suffers, or when it struggles, or when it's in conflict, or when it's reactive, what you see it from is the reality of the moment. Because you see it as a reality as something that's occurring within the reality of the present. And it doesn't take you away as it does when you see it as a reality in its own sake. When you think it's a reality. And we think it's a reality. So then desires just, our mind leaves. Why? Because it's a better outcome than the one we have. Or we wouldn't be desiring. You see? So this is where we have to shore up our resilience, is just not allowing our minds to move in the direction of imagination, but to stay steady with what is, even if it's an unpleasant what is. And so now all the teachings that were earlier offered about staying with unpleasantness didn't somehow feel contrived or combative as they did when I thought desire was something I was fighting against. But rather, you're just opening to the present. The present has, it's unpleasant sometimes. And it's pleasant sometimes. That's it. That's all it ever offers. That's all it can ever give you, is pleasure or its opposite. And if we're willing to experience that, that's all. That's it. That's the summation. Isn't that amazing? And yet our whole life is so tangled around the discord and the contracted way we try to fight our way out of that very obvious truth, very obvious expression of suffering. And so when we begin meditation, you know, we really come into the heart of what the practice is, where the practice is taking us. Now there are two expressions, two events in suffering. One is just whether we're going to follow the desire or not, or the difficulty or not. Whether if we go in that direction, then we're going to be off, and it's going to come back and haunt us. It's going to come back troublesome. If we don't and stay our ground, then it goes away. That particular imaginative response goes away. It doesn't mean others don't come. Others do come. But most of us, and the reason we do, this is the majority of the talk, really, is that we believe in the imaginative response because we have based our life within imagination. We base our life in the thinking of where the thought is taking us, because that's where the momentum of our whole existence is, our whole narrative, our whole life story. So to say, you know, it's as simple as seeing, oh, that's imaginative and that's not, it's yes, it is, and no, it's not that easy. Why? Because our entire life has the momentum of imagination. We're encased in imagination. And so, of course, when we have an imaginative response, we're going to follow it. And this, then, is the next level of our approach to suffering, is from the narrative of our life. It's a much more difficult, you know, that first part could be easily seen. But we can't stay there because that's not the truth of our existence. The truth of our existence is that we believe the imaginative and we don't believe the present. We don't believe the present. The present is something that feels remiss. It's not offering what I want. And our whole culture, the whole culture of the world, is built upon pursuing a life of fulfillment, a future. And so to be able to settle in the present, this is not acceptable. This isn't acceptable. So we really have to take on, if we're going to take on suffering, in my opinion, our narrative, the story-based quality of our life. And that's why, although the first component of suffering, the imaginative and the reality can be seen and more easily seen in a non-distractive environment like a retreat or in the privacy of your aloneness, The second of these things is better seen and involved in the interactive component with other people in Sangha, because that's when our storyline is most frequently enticed and excited explodes out upon the scene. So what are we looking at when we look at the narrative of our life? We're looking at the full-bodied quality of ourselves, because we tell ourselves, you see, even to say this robs you of a certain imaginative need that many of us have in the room here, and that's why we avoid the subject. Because if you really saw yourself who you were as the moment shows you, you'd be translucent. You wouldn't be three-dimensional in the way that you think of yourself as three-dimensional. You wouldn't be solid and encased within a substantial, like a heavy thing. You know, I remember going to an art museum, and it had Japanese Zen art on the second floor. But to get to the second floor, which is where I wanted to go, I had to go through the Western art of the first floor. And everything was solid and, you know, it was all circumstantial, and there were kings and, you know, Jesus, and everything was so solid. It was like, you know, blood and, it was all like that. Love, everything. It was all, you know, mountain, you know, granite. So you walk upstairs and you see the Zen art, you know, I don't know, like 14th century Zen painting. In a single brush stroke, they have a mountain and a person, you know, one brush stroke. And it's all like translucent. It's nothing. It's just a brush stroke. And yet it tells you the whole story of a mountain, a stream, and a person. And the person isn't misrepresented in respect to the mountain. The mountain is equally proportional in the sense that it's as much a part of the painting. And it's mostly canvas with a little bit of black around the corners. You know? And it just, you go, whoa, this is a different perspective of the world. And they're painting it from their perspective. They're as clear in their perspective as the first floor is in our perspective, in the Western perspective. We really think we got it right when we paint the solidity of form in the way we do. But as you quiet, as you begin to bring forth your narrative, to see what's driving your life, the narrative is your driving force of life. It's the reason you do everything you do. It's the logic of your actions. It's the determinant of your thoughts. It's the attitude that you carry with you and us, I don't mean you and not me, us, throughout the day. It's everything. It's why you turn left as opposed to right. And it sets us all up. You know exactly where you're going, you know exactly where you've been. That's part of the three-dimensional quality, is that we live in the basis and the foundation of time. We live with thoughts about where we've been and pushed by those thoughts, often exploited by those thoughts, because those thoughts are often hold us to a kind of painful logic of our past. Talk about deserving, the emotions we have that arise throughout the day. We are loath to give them up because we think that we're deserving of them, to feel sorrow, to feel anxious. We've always been anxious. Of course I'm anxious now. I've lived with anxiety. I had an abusive XYZ. And I married it, and on and on. It's just a fulfillment of the continuation of a theme. And so to say that we see the difference between reality and imagination isn't true. We are living the imagination. And what reality is what the Dharma holds. The Dharma keeps pointing us back to the left. And so we may have seen that a desire, yes, is a fleeting thought, an imaginative response, and that all of time is held within thought, and there's the past and there's the future, all contained in a thought. But we don't live it. We don't live it. We don't even try to live it. We like to visit the second floor of the museum on occasion. But we live on the first floor. That's the floor that makes sense to us. And it's this pain, because once we have assumed ourselves a creature of time, which is imaginative, because where is it? If you can answer that question, if you can show me something, then I will concede to you that your life isn't imaginative. But where is your past? Where is our future? You see, you can't. That's where the Dharma it begins to show you what the reality is. The reality is that we don't have it. We never have had it. And therefore, to carry it along with us as if we have had it is false. It's a painful, because we have to live in accordance to it. We have to live by its standards, by the past, the standards of the past. And the standards of the past are browbeating. You know, they're your father's, your mother's, your XYZ's voice, but mostly they're your voice that's been reinforced that narrative over the length of your life, however many decades we've been alive. And we're very protective about that storyline, about our what we say. But as we get into Dharma, we're beginning to say, okay, this is a story I'm telling myself. We're beginning to lighten up a little bit, hopefully. We should be. And as you do that, things happen. One thing that happens is you don't suffer as much, because you're not living in accordance to the taped response, the habituated response that we always have. And so it's just like you start questioning your story. You start questioning the reality. What assumptions are we living with? What are the assumptions we're living with? I should know that. What are the assumptions I'm living with in my life? What are we saying to ourselves in this moment? What are we believing? Where are our opinions? Where have we invested in our beliefs? What are we projecting onto the innocent? You see? Now this, when we really take on the narrative, it takes us to the next level of investigation, of exploration. Because we haven't finished. In fact, the narrative begins to open us up, like, what's going on here? You know, why this noise in my head? It just compels me towards whatever truth it holds, not the truth that I see objectively, but the truth it holds. So what is that? Where does that all come from? You see, why am I following that blindly? And now comes one aspect of Dharma that few people go into, because now we have to get a sense of how the world is taking, or how when we engage in the world, certain things arise from us from a conditioned response to the world, and certain things from the world are shaped by our conditioned response. And so what we begin to notice as we look more deeply into the causes of our suffering, more nuanced now, is that all formations, everything you see, smell, taste, think, everything that takes form is an interaction. It's not there unless we're there, and we're not there unless it's there. We know ourselves by what we see, smell, sense, taste, etc. And its definition comes from our memory of what it is and how we associate it. So our memory is placed onto it, and in return, it gives us a sense of longevity in regards to whatever it is. Because, oh, I know what that is, and look around, you know what everything is, because you've had a history of similar objects, if not that object, similar objects. And so from that file cabinet, storage bank, we then have a past in which we recognize every object. And that gives me a sense of placement and relationship to an object, the knowledge of. The knowledge of. Now I have knowledge of. When you have knowledge of, you're going to have attention. There's always attention because my knowledge of and your knowledge of are in conflict. You have different knowledge of, and I have different knowledge of. And it's fine as long as it's a generic thing like a light or floor or ceiling. But it gets very contracted and conflictual when it turns into other expressions and opinions of religion, politics, or whatever your knowledge of is in conflict to my knowledge of. So now we have a world in which what we carry within us and how we define the world is in conflict with how everyone else is defining the world and themselves in that particular moment. And it's all because we refuse to see the world as it is, regardless of what our past has been. We see it as we want to interpret it. And so it's fraught with discord. And we think we can work out the discord by convincing other people that we see it correctly. Nobody sees it correctly because we're all seeing it through our imagination, through our history, and there isn't a history. That doesn't leave us a lot. Except it leaves us everything. Because as soon as we're willing to escape the formations of the world, I don't mean escape, because that's the wrong word. We're not fooled by the formations of the world as being the defining point on which I rest my life. Guess what happens? The forms continue. If I want to see them, they're there because the history doesn't go away. It just quiets when I'm not exercising it every second. It gets quiet. And so as it gets quiet, I get quiet because I and it are relative to one another, as I just mentioned. So if I'm allowing it not to be what I've always thought it was, or my beliefs and opinions to be so adamant and so strong, if I just relax the need to keep exercising my voice, you see, why would I exercise my voice? Because it gives me the power of me. That's why I exercise it. That's why I say you're wrong and I'm right. Because I have righteous power now, which keeps me formed and separate from you. And besides that, you're wrong. And who wants to come to a oneness with you? It doesn't work it out. You can't work this thing out this way. Right? And people who have extreme intellects, I'm beginning to notice this actually, it's taken me a while, but it's one of the most powerful aspects in this culture, in particular in the West culture, is the sharp intellect. And there's nothing else that needs to be developed. You don't need to develop a personality, you don't need to develop anything. Relationships, nothing. If you have a powerful mind, a powerful intellect, everybody concedes to that. They give you the highest pinnacle of authority based on your intellect, based upon your discerning, intellectual discerning of objects and knowledge about objects. And so you never, why would you ever want to get into the Dharma? You're already at the top, you see? It's very hard for somebody of that quality of intelligence, and we're talking about extreme now, to want to see what we're pointing to this afternoon, this evening. It's too powerful of an incentive in the culture. But if we're willing, if we're willing just to look, all of everything I have said is not so difficult to discern. So where does that take you? See, now we've looked at the quality of suffering, desire. We've seen how desire is related to time, and time is related to thought. And thought took us into a re-examination of our narrative, which thought-induced narrative is about my attitudes, my beliefs, my past, my future. It takes us into the realm of our history and in our expectations and into our intentional world going forth. And we begin to see that all of this has a craving component to it, which perpetuates it because I don't want to lose the power I have. And to lose my voice, my word voice, power, is to lose everything. So why would I want to be quiet? Why would I want to be quiet? You'd be a fool. You're a fool. You're quiet. You're a fool. You don't have anything to say. You're a fool. Right? You're on your first date. You're not keeping up your end of the conversation. I'm not dating you again. Right? Quiet is not relished in this culture. So we have to relish it. And the only way we relish it is if we see it to be truer than the noise we create. Because why would we give it up for any other reason? It has to be more valid. It has to be the truth. It has to take all of this observation and inquisition, exploration, is showing us something fundamentally true. It has to be done with each one of us, alone, really. And what it begins to show us is something so precious, which is the next level of suffering. We realize now, at this level, at this subtlety, that there is the present, only the present, and that the past keeps intruding into the present as an expression of the present. It doesn't come from somewhere. It doesn't come, it keeps being formed by us from our memories as an expression of the present. And we keep seeing it as an indication of what we remember it to be. So we keep going this way, and it's rising immediately this way. It's coming vertical, and we're going horizontally back into what it reminds me of. So if we can hold the past in the present, so that the past is coming into the present, instead of thinking of it as coming from somewhere else, from a bygone day or year, then it begins to show us the universality, the momentary flicker of life, the complete union. Because if time isn't that way, there's nothing separating us vertically. Nothing. It was only because I have a story of you that defines me that kept us separate. And as long as I kept reminiscing that story, I kept you as someone I relate to and try to get over the bad feelings we've had or whatever it is. But as soon as I allow everything to take its rightful place, suffering ends. Because it's just this. It has no other point but its expression. It's not really even going anywhere. And we can sense something deeply unifying. But we would have had to walk our practice through a lot of observation, a lot jungle weeds of life. Just to come to this. Just to come to this. It's the simplest thing. What could be more simple than just this? And it's only because we don't want it, which is the second noble truth, that it looks like the display rather than just this. But it's always and forever just this, waiting for us to mature sufficiently to lay up our argument. May we do so quickly. Can we sit for a minute or two? And as we sit, let's release the past as it arises. Instead of engaging in the past, feeling the difficulty of it, and then trying to release it long after we've entangled ourselves in it. It's like heat off of a griddle. The end of suffering. So if there are any comments or questions, I'd be happy to see if I can answer. Okay, so the question was about the sense of history being an illusion, but what about karmic forces? So first of all, it's not to deny or base yourself in a place that you know, I don't want to get involved with life because it's just illusory. That's too tricky, okay? The way you move with this thing is to involve yourself fully in the embodiment of life. And at the same moment, you hold the certainty of life being momentary. So the two are really one and the same embodiment. Karma, or the conditioned nature of the past, at first plays itself out in virtually everything we believe or see or identify or understand. That's all karma, because that's what we have known it to be in the past, and that's what we now know it to be in the present. But as we begin to quiet and see the past arising within the present, we begin to see the mutual mergence of the present and karma. The karma isn't something now that's happening to us. It's a part of the living present moment. I called it the past. You can call it karma if you'd like. But as long as we play with it within the identification of our history, then we'll talk about the terrible karmic occurrence that happened to me at such and such, and how could I, you know, and all of the bad karma I've had, and all of that as a reminder of how discouraging and convincing our life has been from the point of view of karma. But when you bring the details into the present, where's the karma? It's just the force of momentum of the past. That's all it is. It's the thing that why we keep believing ourselves going forward, believing in us and believing in whatever we see. That's the karmic influence of our life. And it's all karma when we start, and it begins to wane as we move down the continuum. So we begin to see through the implications, through the momentum, through the urgency of what karma represents, into the settledness of the present. Okay, so if you look at the difference, she was talking about pleasantness or unpleasant within the moment and the suffering that initiates. Okay, so the Buddha's teaching, his longitudinal teaching, is that there are feelings associated with each image, each experience. And then we recoil or advance according to what that feeling is. If it's unpleasant, we go one direction. If it's pleasant, we go the other. What's happening in the human mind in relationship to that is that thinking is beginning at that moment. We see it, we're delighted in it, we then remember it, and we then elaborate upon what we're just seeing. And that then our story of our life comes in as a narrative in relationship to that object that started off as just pleasant. But we've identified it now, recognized it, and now we're moving towards it with the history, with the certainty of the history of what we expect from it, you see? So that sequentiation is suffering because, first of all, it doesn't last, so it's not going to be completely fulfilling, right? And we're pursuing a feeling. And the feeling is coming from us, not from the thing. It's our conditioned expression of what we think it is. So we're the ones that have the pleasantness that's in here that we have now been placed on that thing, person, place, or thing, and we're pursuing that as if the pleasantness that's in here is in there. You see? So that's the first, like, that's very distorted, isn't it? Okay, so now is it possible to have a feeling before it gets, you know, into the expressive story narrative phase and just see it as a feeling, just have it be pleasant? Oh, there's somebody I know, we have a nice friendship. It's a pleasant feeling, that's it. Rather than saying, I've got to go up and I've got to renew our friendship and oh, I've got to tell her the last 20 years of my life or whatever it is, you know, it can be proportional. And so, but the ability to be able to hold a feeling, you know, hold a feeling, I don't mean hold on to a feeling, I mean see a feeling, takes awareness, right? Which awareness doesn't have a feeling. Awareness is that which sees the feeling, experiences the feeling, but it itself is not a feeling. So we're now meeting something that is free of feelings, and the only way something free of feelings can get hooked up into pursuing a feeling is if I tell myself something so that I come alive and chase it. If I just hold it there as awareness seeing, then awareness sees. That's all. That's all. It feels. That's all. It doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't chase anything. It doesn't make a story out of it. It doesn't have a have to or a must to it. And then I'm equally present for the next moment in which an unpleasant feeling occurs, and on and on. So it's, at what point have we given the message of our life over to that feeling? Because whatever that message is, that's how blown up we're going to be in relationship to our pursuit. Directly proportional to that. If it's just, oh, a feeling, well, there's a wisp of self. But if it's, oh my God, I love that, oh my God, strawberry, blah, blah, blah. Then we're very big here, you know. See, I love seeing the proportionality of what my mind does to the world and me as I arise within that dynamic. Because they're one and the same event. And I'm looking out to try to, because the only way I can claim the world and hold on to it is to say that the feeling is in that thing and pursue it. Then it gives me separation, it gives me power, and it gives me intention and purpose. A lot of things which I love as an individual. If I just sit here and say, if it's just a pleasantness, it doesn't give me any of those things, you see? So there is something that I encourage in the wording of my, the selection of my wording. I encourage myself forward.
Silence and how to not
Don't beat me with your silence. No, okay, so the merging of the first and second floor of the museum, and how do you use silence? You don't want to, I mean, you can use silence as a ploy. You know, it can be another egoic endeavor where you're going to be quiet. Yeah, have you? I've had people like that. They drive me crazy where they're going to stare at you, you know, and quiet. It's like out silence you. Don't fake this. I hate that kind of thing. Don't do that. Don't do it. It's just fakey. All right. So, it's true silence. You know, everybody enjoys that. We've done it many times as a collective here. Just all of us together, just consenting to be quiet together. Nobody's doing anything to anyone, and you just—it's like really, it's affirming. It affirms everything, doesn't it? That's what silence does. No one, if you affirm silence, if you just affirm, because it's the foundation on which everything else is built, if you affirm it and that resonates so other people can affirm their silence and everybody rests there, it's not, you're not doing something to somebody, and it certainly isn't pretentious. You know, so that's the kind of silence that I would hope that we would learn to manifest, the silence of being. But when the ego picks it up as a form of control or manipulation, then it looks just like an ego manipulation, and it looks awful. You know, some of these spiritual teachers, you know, run. Really.
And it was just like this.
Right.
Kind of
right.
Right.
So right. Right. So look at your assumptions about the world. Everyone should do this. Everyone should look at their assumptions about the world and start testing them. Is life fair? It is not fair. At no level is it fair. I mean, why should young children sometimes die before their parents? That's not fair. Why should big fish eat small fish? That's not fair, right? Why should somebody cut me off on I-5? It's none of it's fair, right? This is human logic, right? Now, so saying, we're reluctant to give up our laws that we ascribe because we think if we give them up, all hell will break loose. But the truth is that if we give up those laws, a deeper sense of goodness permeates, starts, it comes not from the mind's logic, but from the basic goodness of oneness, of wholeness, of universality. And that is then becomes the motivating driving force. I mean, people talk about, this drives me a little crazy too, about the bodhisattva vow, you know, they're going to go out and do the bodhisattva vow. Well, if it doesn't accompany the perception of wholeness in you, then you're just, that's just another set of pretentious actions, because it's you doing the bodhisattva. This is a change of perception. And yes, we have to engage life through those changing perceptions, but to just hold on to some kind of theory, as beautiful as it sounds, like all working towards the benefit of all sentient beings while you're depleting yourself often, you know, it's just more fracturing. This thing has to accompany all of us. We have to see it. We have to perceive it and then live it. So the living of the Bodhisattva vow is in accordance with the perceptions of what we actually see life to be. Then it's a living reality rather than some vow we're taking, which annoys a lot of people. Okay.